The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
I'm so glad you're with us on the Clark Howard Show, where it's all about you learning ways to save more and spend less, and don't let anyone ever rip you off. Coming up in 20 minutes, an ugly ripoff involving the election season. I'm going to tell you what you need to know to protect yourself from people who want in your wallet. And later this hour, one U.S. car brand has become an absolute beacon of reliability, taking on the world's most expensive luxury vehicles as a traditional car maker. It is great news for our country and great news for your wallet coming your way in just 30 minutes. Our web address, Clark.com. When you have a question for me, Clark.com/ask. And by the way, you have available to you for free off-the-air advice where you can talk with a member of our team. That's easy to get. You go to Clark.com. You'll be able to scroll down and see how to get free off-the-air advice. It's available 45 hours each week, spread out Monday to Friday. I have taken calls from people that have been very disturbing to me about getting ripped off on loans when they're entrepreneurs or small business people. It has been an area that has been full of abuse. Generally, laws concerning consumer protection are silent and ignore you if you are an entrepreneur or a small business. So that's made the area wide open to cons, where they essentially destroy your business with horrific, horrific loans that, by the way, you personally have to guarantee, even though it's a loan to prop up your business. So you may be desperate for cash flow, pay salaries, pay rent, pay whatever, buy inventory, and then you end up getting yourself in a whole lot worse trouble. The crooked lenders, some have used the aura of respectability of a legitimate business in the United States known as factoring. They pretend to be factors. You don't even need to know what that is if you don't have a business. But it's a form of lending that has been long in place and long respected. But crooks have come into that as a way to basically loot the assets of your business and put you into a financial hole that you'll never recover from. In addition, there are lenders that will make quick loan decisions and lend money to a business in some cases just minutes. But what you don't realize is that the interest rates they're charging are sky high in the double digits, perhaps even crossing into triple digit interest rates. And it is a terribly abusive market with no cop on the beat. So now, as online lending to businesses is starting to get a bad reputation because of all the hoodlums that have invaded the space, legitimate players in the business are signing up to a new disclosure box that if you go to borrow money from them, you will see in a simple chart what the rules are of what you're borrowing, what the interest rate will be, and all the key important particulars of the money you're going to borrow. It is going to become a standard that will be easy for you as a business owner to know. It's kind of like the box when you get a solicitation for a credit card. And if you look at it, it'll tell you everything you need to know import about the credit card solicitation you're getting. And you'll be able to see if it's a good deal or not. Same kind of idea for doing a business loan. And the lenders Cabbage, OnDeck, and Can all are the initial signees to having the box. And I'm hoping that pretty quickly this becomes a way for you looking to borrow money. If a lender doesn't show the box, then you know they've got something to hide, and odds are they're going to rip you off. Be careful when you need cash for your business, because unfortunately, there are way too many crooks, way too many con artists that will destroy your dreams. Laura is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Clark. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly. Laura, you have something that's better than the dog ate my homework.
Maybe so.
What happened?
So I was driving down the road with my son last week and rolled down the window, and through a series of events, we had papers fly out the window. And didn't know what papers they were until I looked to see which ones I had left and realized it was paperwork with very personal information for my 10-year-old son. So it had his name, you know, our names as his parents, our address and phone number, his social security number, his passport number.
No.
Birthday, all of it.
No.
Yes.
All right, and you're probably worried that if that inadvertently fell into the wrong hands, which hopefully, likely it did not.
Well, you know, I was not able to stop when it happened. So I did call my husband because it was pretty close to our house. So he went to go look for it. He did find the piece of paper that fell out, but he said it was where he found it. It was at a city bus stop. So he found it, which is great, but in the previous 20 or 25 minutes, could there have been somebody to see it and snap a photo or write down information?
I would imagine if somebody is a crime of opportunity, they would have just picked up the piece of paper and put it in their pocket.
And that's what we thought, too.
So I would say the odds, and how amazing that your husband was able to sleuth so well and find the sheet of paper with the passport number, Social Security. What kind of form, by the way, had to have all that on it? Please tell me it wasn't some school form.
No, not a school form. It was actually, my son does acting, so it was paperwork we filled out for his agent. And that's all information they need, yeah.
Okay. All right. So I would say there's probably not going to be a problem, particularly since your husband found the source document. But if it would make you more comfortable, are you a resident of the state of Florida?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. Florida is one of the roughly half of states in the United States that allow you to freeze a child's credit.
Okay.
And with your 10-year-old working, it makes your child more susceptible to somebody ending up stealing his identity.
Mm-hmm.
So you could consider freezing his credit, but it'll cost you $30.
Okay.
$10 per bureau.
Okay. And is that something, should we look into freezing it, or should we just, is it something we can just kind of keep an eye on and just pull the free credit reports?
No, you can't. Well, see, the thing is, the irony is that a kid generally doesn't have a credit file until mischief has already happened.
Okay.
Because a child starts off with what's known as a no file. There's no record because, you know, normally a kid doesn't have credit of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do to create a credit freeze for a child is they create a dummy file under your child's Social Security number, and then they freeze that file so that anything that comes in as an inquiry against your child's Social Security number is just shut down, essentially.
Okay, and so somebody else would freeze it if they wanted to try to use his number.
I'm sorry?
You're saying somebody else would try to use his number and freeze it?
No, somebody else might try to use his number to get credit.
Right.
Or to apply for a job or whatever. But since you have it frozen, they wouldn't be able to do any of that.
Okay.
So it would be a very inexpensive insurance policy. It does take a little bit of time to do it for a child. It's where for an adult, freezing credit is a quick online process. For a kid, it's a manual process like it's 1965. You have to do everything through the mail.
Oh, okay.
But if you go to my credit freeze guide at Clark.com, you'll see how to do that. But again, because of the weird set of circumstances and your husband recovering the paper, you're almost certainly okay from that incident. But the truth is, when a kid's identity is stolen, it's done surreptitiously. You don't even know they're up to it. In this case, you had something that happened, a fluke, And it's much less likely that his identity is going to be stolen from this fluke.
Okay. And how does a child's identity get stolen? Like, I mean, even my 10-year-old son is asking. He's like, but I'm only 10. How could somebody take a credit card out in my name or something?
Well, many times it won't be specifically for credit. It could be, but somebody might do it because, let's say they have a criminal record and they want to apply for a job that criminal record would eliminate you from it. So they might use his identity, his social security number, maybe not even his name, which is known as synthetic identity theft, where they use his social security number and a different name, but create an identity that if somebody looks, does background, it's not going to show anything, which for somebody who has a past they don't want seen is preferable.
Right.
Or it could be an illegal immigrant who uses somebody's child's social security number as a way to establish legal employment status in the U.S. Could be any of a number of things like that. So it's not necessarily with certainty about getting credit. It can be just doing the theft of his entire identity. KK's with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, KK.
Hey, Clark, how you doing?
Great, thank you. You are a musician.
Yes, I am, sir.
Well, do you know that you have more musical talent in your little pinky than I will ever have in my whole body?
Well, maybe.
I'm telling you, I got no talent on the art side at all of any kind of art.
Oh, man. Well, you know, it's just something that I've been doing for like almost like 10 years now about. So, yeah, so I've definitely, you know, like have that time for that. So, yeah.
Well, let's see if I can be of any help to you since
sure.
I've already told you I'm clueless with no talent.
Okay. Well, yeah, so like in terms of that, I would actually say that my desire is to actually tour, create a strong social media presence and basically make that my full-time, basically, and just, you know, in terms of, like, how to exactly do that, I'm not exactly sure. So just, you know, trying to see, like, what I can do.
Well,
exactly.
I mean, you know, social media can be a real blessing or it can be kind of like a giant frustration.
Yeah.
But with social media, there are a few things that make it click, make it work. You start with the fan base you already have. And what you do is you use social media as a way to tell your story in a way that people would want to share it. You share samples of your songs. You can even share entire songs. If you do, doesn't have to be elaborate, but you do any kind of music video, particularly with people's Facebook feeds, video's the hottest thing on Facebook right now.
Yeah.
And so if you use, and you just don't limit yourself to one outlet. You've got Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat. I mean, there's so many potential outlets, but you come up with a marketing campaign where you don't want to communicate to people too often, but you share with them, you give them value for following you, and you do that as a musician with entertaining them.
Oh, that's actually a really good way to put it. Yeah. That's a really good idea.
Because the number of people, let's face it, even if you got a real popular friend circle just in life, you're not giving them outside that friend circle, you're not giving them any compelling reason to really be interested in you unless it's about your entertainment value that you can provide.
Okay.
And so that's where I think social media can be so powerful.
All right. Okay,
And humor works. So when you are communicating with people, as much as you can entertain multimedia and provide some sense of humor along the way, you'll build up a following. If you have a sound that intrigues people or entertains them, and that's why social media can be frustrating because if you're not able to communicate that message well, you're spinning your wheels. So really think through, look at other people who are emerging in the music scene and see how they communicate in social media to their followers and what really looks like stuff that intrigues you and captures you. Emulate those strategies to bring your message to people who you hope will become your fans. In the midst of this election season, I need to make sure you are aware of a hot scam that pretends to be pollsters calling you. This is apparently happening all around the country, but especially in battleground states. So here's what happens. You get called by a pollster asking you about your position on Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, Gary Johnson, whatever. And in return for you giving your opinion, taking the time to share your opinion, well, then the scam comes, and wait till you hear how it plays in today's Clarkrageous moment.
Scams, ripoffs, outrages. It's a Clarkrageous moment.
So what's happening is that you're told that you have won a prize for having participated in the presidential poll, and all you need to do is pay shipping and handling to receive your prize. You then give the supposed pollster your credit card number, debit card number, your checking account number, and, well, they weren't real pollsters. Better Business Bureau is hearing reports about this around the country. You need to know that somebody says they're offering you a prize to state your opinion. What they're actually trying to do is empty your wallet.
Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans proudly supports this podcast. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage approval process into the 21st century. It's fast, powerful, and completely online. You see, Rocket Mortgage has taken all the complicated, time-consuming parts of applying for a mortgage out of the equation. Hate searching through stacks of old files and paperwork? Well, with Rocket Mortgage, you can easily share your bank statements and pay stubs at the touch of a button. It helps you get approved in minutes for a custom mortgage solution that's been tailored to your unique financial situation. Even better, with Rocket Mortgage, you can do all of this on your phone or tablet. It's a quick online process that you can manage from the convenience of your couch. So if you're looking to refinance your mortgage or buy a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/save. That's quickenloans.com/SAVE. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
Looking for fast-paced tales of action, adventure, sci-fi, mystery, and crime? Look no further than Telling Stories, the weekly podcast that brings you a free full-length drama each week in 5 daily episodes. Tune in to hear the world's great stories performed by America's greatest storytellers. Look for Telling Stories, the podcast, right here on Podcast One and iTunes.
I'm so glad you're with us on the Clark Howard Show. You know what this show is about? You keeping more of what you make. You can follow me at facebook.com/Clark Howard, on the web, clark.com. You got a question? clark.com/ask. All right. The courts, just in the last few minutes, the courts have finalized what's going to happen to you if you have a Volkswagen diesel that is one of the cheat diesels that turned out to be spewing out 40 times the air pollution they claim they were. So if you want to turn your Volkswagen in, depending on the year and miles and all that, you will get between $12,000 and $44,000 for your Volkswagen. If you want to keep it and have Volkswagen fix it, in other words, fix the pollution problem, you know, the gripe I've heard from callers about this is that if Volkswagen does the fix, they'll have to deal with the pollution. You'll have a double whammy of much worse fuel economy and not as good a peppiness or performance. I'm not smart enough to tell you if that's true or not, but that's been the gripe from people. But anyway, if you want to keep your Volkswagen, have Volkswagen fix the emission issues, you'll get somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000 in reparations in addition to being able to keep your car. So those will be your options. $12,000 to $44,000 to dump your car, $5,000 to $10,000 to keep your car. So I don't know what I would do if I had one. All depends on how much you love it, I guess. Speaking of loving cars, Consumer Reports puts out what's considered to be the most respected reliability review of car brands. You know, which ones do the best job of keeping you on the road instead of in the repair shop. And the news for America could not be better, because for the first time I can recall, an American car maker finished at the top of the heap, not number one, but right in the hunt, and that's Buick. Buick got an outstanding score for reliability, only exceeded by the perennial winner, Lexus, and Lexus's main market brand, Toyota. So win, place, and show, Lexus, Toyota, Buick. And how good is that? But I'll tell you what's even better. When you look at the top brands, several are not luxury brands. So we have Toyota in two, Buick in three, Audi, that is a luxury expensive brand, in fourth, Kia in fifth, Mazda in sixth, Hyundai in seventh. How about that? A lot of very affordable vehicles, relatively speaking, that are extremely reliable. On the other hand, who did terrible in reliability? That was terrible grammar. Who did terribly in reliability? Let's try that again. Porsche, Mercedes, Ford, Volvo, Lincoln, Cadillac. So you think about those, how many of those are luxury vehicles? And you know who else did terribly in this? Tesla. Tesla has a new SUV called the Model X that has had endless problems with the doors opening and closing and other things like that. And the S, their sedan, got a very good reliability rating and is on the recommended to buy list. But the X is so messed up that it pulled down the thing. Now, any X owner I talk to loves their X, but I guess it's kind of like, I was about to give a reference about a European country that's known for having very artsy things, but not very reliable. I'm going to step back from that. Leave that alone. I don't need to infuriate anybody. Anyway, I'm just so excited, though, that so many brands that are moderately priced vehicle brands are so reliable. And by the way, this trends many years. The J.D. Power 3-year reliability survey and Consumer Reports will spread pretty far from each other. Not this time. They show very similar in terms of which vehicles are among the most reliable and least reliable vehicles for you to own. And Mike is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Clark. How are you today?
Great, thank you. So you want to talk about the Volkswagen buyback?
Yeah, I do. First of all, I love my diesel. I love it. It's my third one. And I only took the buyback because, as you alluded to, the fix is not going to be good. I'm a scientist, and I know it's not going to be good. It's going to turn the car from a sort of a German rocket into a brick.
Yeah, because most people don't know that the diesel is fast off the mark, that it's really, really fun. It's zippy.
I've got my 210 is a 2-liter, and it's got the their automatic transmission in it. And I'll have people in the car, and I will stop at a stoplight, and I'll just floor it. And we'll pull away, and I'll say, you know what kind of engine this has got? And they'll say, no. I said, it's got a diesel. A what? I mean, it's just a rocket. However.
But, Mike, you're not old enough to know many older Americans' first experiences with diesel were during the 1980s when some American automakers tried to put diesels in cars, and they just didn't know what they were doing.
Mark, you are Clark. Excuse me. You are you're underestimating my age. I'm 74.
Oh, but, well. So you remember the disastrous diesels from the 80s. So people thought they were very slow. They thought they were very unreliable. They thought they just belched pollution like you've never seen.
And the people that did that, they made a mistake. They tried to turn the gas engines into diesels, and they weren't built for that, and that ruined that market. But what I called about, Mark, or Clark, excuse me.
I answered anything. Hey, you, yeah, whatever you were calling.
So do I. Mostly, hey, you. Yeah. I bought this car. I'll tell you where I am on this thing. I bought this car a little over 2.5 years ago. It was a very good used automobile. I'm second owner, and I bought it for like $14,000, which was a great price. And now Volkswagen's going to come back, and the estimate is $13,200. So, and I'm buying a new. I bought a new Jetta for roughly $7,000 more. So my out-of-pocket for a 7-year new car is $7,000. So to me, that was a no-brainer. The question I have, Clark, is that I have a loan on this thing for 60 months at 2.39%. And the payments are not going to kill me. But I'm also paying my house down at a very rapid rate. I want to, when I finally retire, not have a house payment or a mortgage payment. Would I be better off to pay off, put the money on the house? I think I would, because it's at 4.375, a higher percentage. Or should I put it on the car and just get rid of the payment?
I think you put it towards the house. And how much do you still owe on your home?
$86,000.
All right. So I'm going to suggest something crazy. How many years are you thinking you're going to be paying on the house?
If I told you how fast I'm paying this thing off, you're going to think I'm insane. I have paid in 6 years, I have paid off $45,000 on it.
So you're looking at sometime in less than 10 years paying it off?
Yeah, at the rate I'm going, I will have this thing paid off in 3 years, honestly.
Oh, 3 years. Okay, if you're, then I'm not even going to make the suggestion I was going to make, which was for you to look at doing a 7-year loan at a credit union. Mm-hmm. Or doing a 5-1 at a credit union where you get a fixed rate for 5 years, because those rates are down in the twos.
Right, they are. And I've talked to various people, and they said, hey, what you're doing, by the time you refinance, it'll cost you more.
Yeah, that was my concern. Just keep doing just what you're doing, and don't put the money towards the car loan.
You are absolutely wonderful. That's what I wanted to hear.
Well, I'm so glad I was able to help, and best to you, and what a deal Volkswagen's dishonesty ended up creating for you with leveraging a 7-year-old vehicle into a new one at very little net cost. Very unusual. Wanda's with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Wanda.
Hello. How are you?
Great. Thank you. Wanda, you want to talk about your grandkids. How many do you have?
I have two.
And how old are they?
One and three, almost four.
Well, how can I be of service with your grandkids?
I want to start a savings account for them in my name that I can hold control of in my name, so I can just put, you know, what I want to into it when I want to. And my question is the best way to do this, and how can I do it without, or is there a way to do it without being taxed?
So, the money you want to put aside, are you thinking of this just being money that will flow to them when they're adults, or do you have any interest in helping to pay? I don't know if in your family culture they're likely to go to college. Like, right. What are you thinking of? Because it changes how I would answer this.
Right. I was thinking in terms of college, and I saw the 529 plan. I believe that's it. But I want to set it up so they can use it whether or not they go to college.
All right, so that gets complicated. Here's the hard part. So you said no tax. If you put money into a 529 account for the four-year-old and the one-year-old grandchild. You know, you open one for each of them. And they use it for college. All the money in the account is completely tax-free. Everything it earns over the next, you know, 14 years for one of them, 17 years for the other, it all is, every penny you earn, Uncle Sam gets nothing.
Okay.
And it just goes to them. On the other hand, you're the owner of the account all the way through that time period, because you said to me you wanted to make sure you owned it, because you don't want a kid to end up being able, if they're immature or whatever, to blow the cash, right?
Right, right.
So that's the beauty of the 529, is you're able to control it. And then the neat thing is, if you have one grandkid who decides to go to college and the other not, you can move the money tax-free to the benefit of the kid who goes to college. And then at that point, if you want to give some cash directly to the one who would at that point be an adult who does not go to college, you should just give them cash.
Okay.
That's the most efficient thing you could do. What are the odds in your family these kids will go to college?
Pretty good. Pretty good.
So if that's a, that's how I like to frame that, because everything else you do becomes more complicated. If you open a custodial account for each child, with you being the custodian for the four-year-old on one and the one-year-old on the other, when they reach adulthood, and depending on your state, typically that would be 18 or 21, they get the money, and you have no say-so over what they do with it.
All right. The question I had also was, if will I be taxed on the amount in that
In that scenario,
account?
No, the kids are responsible for the tax. But the reality is, unless you're putting aside significant amounts of money, it's almost a non-taxable thing anyway.
Okay, okay.
How much money are you thinking?
Oh, I'm just thinking small amounts, like starting at a couple hundred and adding to it.
Okay.
Monthly.
Yeah, so that's not going to generate any large amount of tax.
Okay.
And you could, if this is long-term for the kids, you could, if you open custodial accounts, look at some of the investment choices I have, where there'd be more risk with the money short-term, but it's not for short-term, it's for long-term.
Okay.
And then the tax treatment's more favorable, too, if the money's invested instead of put in a savings account.
Okay. So you think probably the 529 for college would be the best way to go?
I do. Since you say the odds are good that they'll go to college, I would do the 529s, Wanda. And you open, again, you open two accounts, each you own, and each account is for a different beneficiary, your four-year-old grandkid and your one-year-old grandchild. And if you go to my guide at clark.com on 529 plans, I'll walk you through exactly how to open it, what to fund it with, and what investments I recommend in each of those. John joins us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, John.
How are you, Clark?
How's it going?
Well, I can't complain. It's a beautiful, sunny day.
Well, how perfect is that? But you want to talk about clouds on the horizon, the clouds that would make you worried about having any regular money and having instead gold.
Yes, basically.
So tell me about your thoughts with gold.
Well, in the past, I have purchased stocks with gold and silver, and I've done very well on them, in many cases tripled my money. Now I'm kind of curious about where you stand on buying the actual bullion.
I'm a much bigger fan of you doing what you've done. So you were buying gold exchange traded funds, ETFs?
Correct.
Yeah, I think that's the only wise way to do it. Because if you buy physical gold, you've got a buy-sell spread on the price where you get a little bit ripped off on what they sell it to you for. Then you get a little bit ripped off on what they buy it back from you for. You have to store it. You have to worry about theft. It's not as convertible as quickly into cash as you have with the exchange-traded fund. It's much cheaper and much more efficient to own gold or any precious metal with an exchange traded fund, an ETF, which for people who aren't familiar with what that is, I should say, John, that essentially it's like buying a stock rather than buying the physical gold. But the gold is stored for you by the fund in a vault, in a safe place to protect your investment. So if gold is where you think it's at, physical gold is not where I would be.
Okay.
And how much of your assets do you put into gold or precious metals?
Well, right now I don't have any. My wife and I are both retired. We have both divine benefit pension plans. We have been debt-free for a number of years, so we owe nothing on cars, homes. We carry no credit card debt.
So gold for you is only a protective hedge against bad news?
In a sense, yes.
So I would say in your case that you are in such a solid, secure financial situation with you and your wife. You don't have debt. You got nice, steady income, that gold and precious metals is just for a rainy day.
You know, there's something about TrueCar that a lot of people don't even know. Here it is. Using TrueCar can also help you buy a used car. That's right. In fact, there are over 500,000 pre-owned vehicles available from TrueCar's certified dealers nationwide. So whether you're looking to buy a brand new car or a used car, you can get all the upfront pricing information that empowers you. You can also get discounts off the list price for used cars and a totally better buying experience through the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. That's where you see what other people paid for the car that you want, so you know you're getting a fair price and you can feel confident. And with TrueCar, you connect with a local certified dealer of your choice, so you can enjoy a quick, easy buying experience. You can use the TrueCar website or the TrueCar app, so it's easy to find the new or used car that you want. You just take your guaranteed savings certificate to a TrueCar certified dealer, and you'll save money on that used car. And if you're buying new, the average TrueCar user saves $3,279 off MSRP. Over 2 million people have already bought their cars through the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. So if you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit TrueCar.com or take it with you by downloading the TrueCar app and enjoy a better car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states.
Glad you've joined us here on the Clark Howard Show, where it's about your empowerment with knowledge so you can keep more of what you make. Coming up in a half hour, the number one mistake you can make in your home. I'm going to tell you what it is, how to set it right. Our web address, clark.com. When you have a question for me, clark.com/ask. So I've been noticing on the channels that I monitor on TV, both the business channels and the cable news channels, they're all over the story about the average premium increase on the individual healthcare exchange for next year is an astronomical, outrageous 22%. The individual market for health coverage in most states is now in what's known as a death spiral, what they call a death spiral in the insurance business. And I've discussed with you before what the problem is, and it's something that pointy-headed economists refer to as adverse selection, is that people, as premiums start to rise, people only see it as worth it to have insurance if they are older or if they have illnesses, they're not in good health. And so then they get coverage, and other people who are younger and healthier say, hey, I can just pay the penalty and I'll go without insurance. And so as you end up with a pool that gets smaller and more people that are more expensive to provide care for, the market gets crushed. And that's exactly the scenario that appears to be playing out with the individual market for Obamacare. Now, the politicians, it is a hyper-partisan election season, the politicians are using this is a way to score points. And the truth is, I don't care if it's election season or not, the way we're providing health coverage in the United States is broken. The question is, how do you fix it? And the solutions never work as a soundbite. The healthcare market is incredibly complicated, and more so than it needs to be. The truth is, the underlying real problem, because the big premium increases with Obamacare for the individual market are a symptom of the problem. And the problem is, we have the most inefficient healthcare delivery system in the United States. It is the most expensive in the world, in the United States. We have enormously high cost, have worse outcomes than dozens of other countries in the world, including some third world countries, shorter lifespans than a number of third world countries. In spite of us spending nearly 20% of our nation's wealth on health coverage, health care in the United States, forget coverage, on health care, and get a worse result than countries that don't have nearly as large an economy as us and spend somewhere 5 to 7% of their nation's output of goods and services. So whatever happens politically, if we want to get real about the economics of healthcare, we need to rip apart how we provide healthcare in the United States. And number one on my agenda would be to allow physician's assistants and nurse practitioners to open up independent practices as primary care medical providers. Because if you look at where the greatest harm comes to people's health and ultimately the greatest cost of providing care, it's that people don't seek care till they have a serious illness in many cases. And people don't have access to a primary care medical provider who they can have history with, who knows who they are, knows their background and story, and can provide what's known as continuity of care. If we're going to get serious about fixing things, it has to start with having enough primary care people in the country, because people go to medical school overwhelmingly are turning their backs on being primary care. They're going into specialization because that's where the money is. But the main need in medical care is for primary care. And it's not going to happen from MDs. The only way that need's going to be met is from the nurses and the PAs. So that's number one. Number two, we absolutely have to change the entire orientation of how we provide healthcare coverage in the United States. A lot of people are really happy that they get healthcare coverage through their employer. But the reality is, that's one of the great distortions of having a real market for how people get healthcare in the United States, is having employers in the mix distorting the delivery of medical services. Each individual should choose whether to buy coverage or not. And what coverage you choose to buy, there should be more freedom about that. But again, none of the things about healthcare fit a politician's soundbite or an 8-second segment on a newscast. The issues are difficult, and it's such a key competitive factor for us in the U.S., with us having an arm tied behind our backs by spending more than double what any other country in the world spends per capita on health care. That we, just for our nation's competitiveness, because we keep talking about jobs, jobs, jobs in America, and having good jobs and all that. Well, if we're going to compete with other countries, we've got to get the healthcare thing under control. So it's also an area where experimentation is very important, because I don't care how bright somebody is, how much time they've spent in healthcare, there's so many layers to it that no one individual, no one political party, no one idea solves this. It's one that we have to work on together. And one way I think we should look at it is 50 state laboratories. Roberta's with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Roberta.
Hi.
Roberta, you've got credit card debt that you'd like to get out of your life.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my question today.
Certainly. So talk to me about your credit cards.
I have a little over $4,000 in debt with one credit card, and I'm interested in looking for a company that will offer like 0% interest for X months. And I see some out there for 9 months, 15 months. But my issue is, my question is, without going through the application process and letting them take the time to tap on my credit, how do I know that they will be able to supply me with the amount of limit that I need to transfer my balance transfer with the 0% offer?
Well, do you happen to know what your current credit score is?
Yes, it's an average score.
Okay. And give me
it's almost a 7.
Okay. So you're above a 660.
Yes.
All right. So every point you get above 660 means that you have a better opportunity to qualify for an offer. You don't qualify for the best offers on credit cards typically till you go above around a 740. Okay. But if you're above a 660 on the FICO score scale, then you have an opportunity to qualify. But as to whether or not someone will make you an offer for a decent 0% balance transfer deal, I'm not certain.
Right.
But the thing that I would like you to do is be judicious in applying, and apply only for maybe a couple of offers, and do them on the same day, because you'll know instantly if you're approved or not.
Okay.
So if you get rejected by one, you turn around and you look at the other. Now, okay. At Clark.com, I don't know if you saw, we've got the best zero interest rate offers available right now, which what makes them best in my book is there's no balance transfer fee.
Yes, I noticed that, and I did apply. Yes, absolutely. And that's the issue. That's the problem. Without knowing what they're going to offer me to make sure it's going to cover my $4,300 in debt, I was offered $1,000. That's not going to be enough.
Not enough. But if you, so that's why you do it in the same day.
Okay.
Because the credit app you did for one will not reflect negatively on another or another if you do them all in a very short window.
Okay.
Because credit reporting doesn't work that rapid fire.
Okay, great.
So you can almost be experimental. Now, in turn, you will, after, if you do multiple apps and those then reflect on your credit, you'll lower your score by a dozen or so points. But right. That is a temporary effect, not a long one. And if you can go to 0%, that's obviously a benefit.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking my question today.
But I'm not done with you, because I have a question for you.
Okay.
What is your plan, your goal, for how quickly you'll extinguish the $4,000?
My income is going to be half will be applied to my credit card debt and have it paid off within 6 months, 9 months, whatever the program is. I'm going to budget that.
Fantastic. Okay. Because that's the thing. I always want you to have what the goal is, how much you're going to have to pay per month to reach that goal. Otherwise, you're just rearranging debt instead of getting rid of debt. And you've got the plan. Sounds like your heart's in it. You're going to make it happen. David's with us on the Clark Howard Show. David,
Hello. You're
traveling coast to coast.
Yes, sir.
Well, tell me about that. How can I help?
Okay, so I have a little dilemma I'm sure you can help me with. It's we've been offered or asked to attend a family wedding, and it's in Florida. We're in Los Angeles, family of four. And, of course, around Christmas time, they triple the flight prices, so we're going to get hammered.
And where in Florida are you headed?
Well, L.A. to Florida.
No, but where in Florida?
Miami, big hub, or Fort Lauderdale. Either one would work.
Yeah, usually Fort Lauderdale will be significantly cheaper because Fort Lauderdale, you know, American dominates Miami.
Right.
And the fares are so much cheaper into Fort Lauderdale generally because of all the competition there. And I'm showing, when are you going?
The 28th of December. Well, that's the wedding day. So any time around
like
that.
The day before or something.
The kids are out of school, so we could go as early as 3 days before. Or we just try not to have to be there for Christmas. We'd rather be here in L.A. for Christmas.
All right. So you shouldn't have any trouble at all finding a cheap fare for that, because that route has, you've got JetBlue, you've got Virgin America, and you've got Spirit. You got to know Spirit's a tough experience. But with those three in the market, I'm looking at I just pulled up the wedding day. Should have looked the day before. But the fares are as cheap as $162 one way.
Wow.
Day
I
before,
wasn't seeing that. I was seeing a total of coming up to close to $800 round trip.
All right, let me tell you where I would go look. I've got two favorite airfare search engines I would look at.
Okay.
And I would go look at google.com/flights, which is the most sophisticated airfare search engine we've ever had.
Okay, I wrote that down.
And then look at kayak.com.
Okay.
And Southwest doesn't show in either of their databases. Southwest is so big in L.A. and Fort Lauderdale that I would look at southwest.com.
Okay, so I got three.
Yeah, and I think you show some flexibility, going date and return date, you'll do fine. Now, have you ever flown Spirit?
No.
Do you know who they are?
Yeah, well, yes and no. We typically stick to the first two that you mentioned because the kids like the TVs on the back of the seats.
Yeah, Virgin America, you know, is the nation's best airline by survey every single year they've been in existence.
We use them a lot.
Yeah, they are a superior airline. And unfortunately, you know, they're going away.
I know, I heard.
Yeah, but they are extraordinary. It's the first time in the United States we've ever had an ultra-classy airline like they have all across Asia. It's time for Ask Clark. That's where you post a question for me on Clark.com, and then Joel, our producer, asks your question for you. Who you got, Joel?
Clark, Barbara wants to know. She says, I've got a Keurig 2.0, and I can't get any reusable cups to work on it. Do you have any suggestions?
Yeah, we have a video that Krista and I shot that you can look at Clark.com that walks you through how to defeat the terrible, terrible, anti-consumer, rotten behavior of Keurig with the 2.0 machines. The other thing you should know, if you do decide to buy a Keurig-type machine, a K-Cup machine, through the Christmas shopping season, look for ones that are not 2.0s. They're still available, they're cheaper, and you can use the reusables in them. You can use K-Cup-type coffee thingies that have not been blocked by Keurig, which they've done with the 2.0s.
All right, Clark, and Veronica wrote in. She says, Clark, I've heard you talk about no-contract home alarm systems, but can you share one or two that you like?
Well, the one that's the biggest in the country is Simply Safe, S-I-M-P-L-I, Safe. But if you want one where they do the whole kit and caboodle for you, you call around to burglar alarm companies you find online. All you have to ask them first question, do you require a contract?
Stay tuned for 60 seconds of AP News headlines right after this podcast.
Welcome to the Clark Howard Show, where it's about you and your wallet. I want you to learn ideas from me so you can save more and spend less. And don't let anyone ever, ever rip you off. On the web, Clark.com. When you have a question, Clark.com/ask. So, when I'm asked questions by people who own a home about homeowners insurance, the number one question I get is a complaint. My insurer raised my premium on me for my homeowner's insurance because they said that I didn't have enough coverage. Isn't that a ripoff? Actually, no. Usually they're doing you a big fat favor because insurers now have very strict rules on in the event you have a significant loss in your home, a catastrophic loss to it, that they will only pay pretty much up to the limits stated in your policy. The reality is if a home sustains meaningful damage or if a home is destroyed, it will cost much more per square foot to repair it or rebuild it than it would cost as brand new out of the ground construction, especially in a typical suburban neighborhood where it was part of any kind of housing development, where there's such efficiency, what's known as economies of scale, for a builder building one house after another, after another, after another, all in a row, where the plumber's working on one while the carpenter's working on another, while the sheetrockers are working on yet another, blah, blah, blah. So they can build effectively at a much lower cost per foot. So if you have a house that has a problem and it has to be fixed, it's far more expensive than you realize to do that. So making sure you're adequately insured on your home is ultra important, and an insurer that pushes you to raise that is doing you a favor. Now, you can, at the same time, to bring that premium back down, scare yourself, but do what I encourage you to do, which is raise the deductible before the insurer is involved. So you won't ever be tempted to make a small claim, because insurers hate you for making a small claim. Many times they'll fire you as an insured for making a small claim. Another issue is if you live in a condo, and more Americans live in condos instead of traditional houses, people are under the assumption that the condo, part of your monthly condo fee, you're paying for condo association insurance where they're insuring the condo, and you don't even know that that doesn't pay for anything pretty much inside your place. And some industry stats say half of people who live in condos are uninsured. So you could end up with a massive out-of-pocket even after the condo does the part that it is legally required to do. Like, depending on your condo, they may not even do sheetrocking inside your place when it has to be rebuilt. And everything about flooring and carpeting and painting and appliances and all that could just as likely be on you, not your association. So if you're in a condo, your insurance is really cheap compared to homeowners. But the shocker is how few people have it. So there are a couple of things you want to know. How far does your condo association actually take their responsibility? And the management company for your condo can tell you right away, oh, we pay only for this, or we pay to this far. And that tells you what to buy in an ultra-cheap condo policy. And remember, your possessions are only covered if you cover them. And the stunner also in an apartment, when I always talk about renter's insurance, if there's a water intrusion into your place because somebody's plumbing got messed up or whatever in an apartment or a condo, it is your insurance that normally will pay for that. If you don't have insurance as a renter, you don't have that condo policy as a condo owner, well, that comes out of your pocket, even though the water came from somewhere else. Kelly's with us on the Clark Howard Show. Kelly, you are trying to take good care of your employees, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm trying.
And what brick wall are you running into trying to help them?
Well, I had the idea of opening a child care FSA, and I wanted to do it by the end of the year. and our payroll company is charging us a small fortune to get it set up and to maintain it, and I was hoping there was a better option.
Yeah, and the payroll services want to take me out and shoot me whenever I mention this, but have you heard of a platform called Zenefits?
No, I have not.
Zenefits. And it is a fast-growing, but in the industry, a controversial company because they are completely different in terms of the pricing models for things. Like for setting up an FSA with them, well, you'll need to tell me what the payroll service was quoting, but Zenefits is $5 an employee a month to set up an FSA.
Okay. Yeah, so our payroll company wanted to charge $100 a month and $1,000 to set it up.
Wow. How many employees do you have?
About 10.
Yeah, so that Zenefits would be a lot cheaper. Do you know what you pay for payroll right now?
Yeah, I've got a decent deal on that, but it took a lot of negotiating.
And what do you think you pay? Do you know what you pay per month for that?
I think all in, maybe like 45 or 50 bucks.
That's very good.
Per pay period.
Yeah, that's very good. I would look at Zenefits and go back to your, because you can go there, Zenefits.com, look at it, and look at what they offer. Go back to your payroll service and say, all you have to say is, I'm thinking of switching to Zenefits because they'll do the FSA for me for so much less than you will with no setup charge. Is there something you can do for me?
Okay.
And if they say no, you could consider switching your payroll and getting the FSA and all that from them. I don't know if you can do the payroll with who you're doing it and then do the FSA through Zenefits or not. I would check with Zenefits before you would call your payroll service. Because if you can pick and choose like that, you could use... If you could do that, and I don't know the answer to that, you could leave your good payroll deal in place and then do the FSA with Zenefits, potentially.
All right, that sounds good.
And you will find with any traditional payroll service, they're going to rip you off on the FSA, and if you do an HSA for your employees, they'll rip you off on that too.
Okay.
It's just part of how that business works. And, you know,
Alrighty.
It's a really neat thing you want to do, the child care, dependent care allowance for your employees. Because it's
we've
a phenomenal.
Got a lot of little ones around here.
What's that?
We have a lot of little ones in the office, so it'll be nice.
It's a huge benefit for your employees because they can put aside, what is it, $5,000 a year that's pre-tax instead of after-tax? Or is it five? Is it five? Yeah. I mean, that is great. And by the way, I'm so glad you mentioned this. You came to me with this question, Kelly, because here we are at the edge of open enrollment season for people who get benefits packages from their employers. And if you have young kids and you don't know about this benefit and you're not using it, you're leaving money on the table. Like if you use childcare for kids or anything like that, send them to summer camp, you can, after school programs, up to age, I think, 14 maybe, you can set aside an amount up to the $5,000, and the bills you're paying now that you're having to use your after-tax income for, you can convert instead and use before-tax income, which effectively means your money goes, for the typical person, 30% further. Tracy's with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Tracy.
Hi, Clark. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Tracy, you want to talk about Wells Fargo.
Yes, sir. Over the weekend, I read Wells Fargo lost its accreditation, and there will likely be a criminal investigation into the bank. Well, that leaves me concerned.
All right. Now, I don't know what you mean by accreditation. I've not specifically heard that, only with the Better Business Bureau. The Better Business Bureau, I guess, has given them an F. But so they're not a accredited business with the Better Business Bureau anymore because of all the illegal activities. I don't even have to say alleged. There's no question that Wells Fargo was involved in a multi-year conspiracy, criminal conspiracy, doing illegal activities, harming millions of customers.
Exactly.
And so where do you fit into this with them?
Well, I have money at Wells Fargo, so I'm trying to find out, does that affect my money? Like, if something happens to Wells Fargo and in this criminal investigation, is my money insured?
Yeah, your money's completely safe being there. And, you know, Wells Fargo is, as they refer to, too big to fail, too big to jail. You know, that if you or I committed crimes anywhere like happened at Wells Fargo over what now appears to be a roughly 9-year period, if we did anything like these things, we would become very familiar with 3 free meals a day and having a lot of people as roommates we didn't pick, right?
Right.
We'd be in jail.
Right.
And, you know, the Wells Fargo chieftains still have their millions, still have their private country clubs, still have their private jets, still have their ultra cushy lives and retirement packages, and no consequences so far. Now, you mentioned accurately that there has not been a very well kept secret. There is now a very active criminal investigation going on in the state of California, where Wells Fargo is based, to see if there are going to be criminal indictments handed down. And it would be great to see the big shots there do the perp walk, because their behavior is reprehensible. So the thing is, in a normal business, if people knew that they had been, there was a lot of cheating going on, a lot of lying, a lot of stealing, a lot of criminal activity, people would just not do business with them anymore. But with a bank, there's a lot of work involved, or at least it, we perceive it to be a lot of work, to change who we do business with. And so Wells Fargo has only been hurt in a minor way by people who've closed accounts. So don't worry about your money being safe. Your money is completely safe, Tracy, insured by an agency of the federal government up to $250,000.
Awesome.
So the question, the decision you would make is, can you trust these clowns?
Yeah, I am looking into other banks right now, but until I was able to move the money, I just wanted to make sure that my money was okay.
Your money is A-OK, safe, and don't just look at banks. Look at credit unions, too. Look at online banks. There are a lot of alternatives that, and don't go look at the other 3 giant monster mega banks. I mean, they've all had their issues. And so when you look for where you take your checking, your savings, CDs, whatever, look beyond the 4 giant monster mega banks, because they, I mean, you think about all the stuff in the past that were issues with Bank of America that seems, as best I can tell, to have cleaned up its act. But Wells Fargo, they got a lot to account for, and hopefully they will be held to account. One of the ways you can ask a question on the Clark Howard Show is to post one for me. We call them Ask Clark. And then Joel, our producer, asks your question for you. Joel, what you got?
Clark, we got a question from Wayne. He says, Clark, you have recommended Credit Karma for ages, and I love using them. They're truly a great service. However, you're also rabidly against arbitration clauses in mandatory terms of service. And recently, Credit Karma added a mutual arbitration clause to their terms of service. So we now have to waive our right to trial or participate in a class action lawsuit. How does this affect your thoughts on Credit Karma?
Well, I was steaming when I got that notice from Credit Karma myself, and we've heard from, gosh, I don't even know how many people have posted about this on Clark.com. There are a lot of very, very unhappy people. I keep trying to think through why Credit Karma would even do this when the services they offer are free. And the only thing I could come up with is that if they had a data breach and somebody's information became at risk, you know, immediately somebody comes and sues them, class action lawsuit, they may be worried about that kind of thing. But I cannot stand these mandatory arbitration clauses. I despise them. because the whole idea of saying that one of our branches of government is no longer there, our right to the courts, to me, is wrong, wrong, wrong. And Joel, I think that I'd like if you could contact Credit Karma and let's hear from them why they're doing something that, in my book, is so stacked deck against the consumer.
Definitely. We'll reach out to them and get word back to our listeners as soon as possible.
Okay.
All right. And Ruben had a question too, Clark. He says, do you have any advice on paying the least amount possible for my cremation someday?
I love when somebody has the casual attitude about death that I do, because most people are in very hushed tones and they can't really talk about it and makes them uncomfortable. And the reality is, all of us are going to perish at some point. And you're doing a huge favor to your loved ones that will be grieving your loss if you figure out in advance what you want. Now, the cheapest way to do it, and one that I got some pushback on, some people who thought I was being insensitive, was when I talked about how I want my body donated to science so there'll be no cost to my family for disposing of me. Some people who thought that was very, very callous. But anyway, my thinking is I want my organs donated, and then whatever else is left after my organs are harvested, I want the rest of it to be my body to be used for medical research. I don't care if it's medical students slicing me up, whatever. I just want to be able to do what I can to advance science and medicine. And then there's no cost typically for what would happen next. But if you want to do the cheapest cremation, cremation has become a very competitive market, particularly in larger metro areas of the country. You can actually shop it. In addition, the nonprofit funeral and memorial societies around the country offer group buying power on having a cremation done, and you can lower the cost a great deal. You can check at funerals.org to see if there's a chapter where you live.
Thanks for listening to the Clark Howard Podcast. Download new episodes every Monday through Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.